Welcome to Grief is My Side Hustle. This is Megan Reardon-Jarvis, your host, as always. I have already explained to my guest today that not only did her book make me cry like 100 times when I was reading it, it made me cry this morning when I was trying to go back and find a passage to ask her to read. So I'm not going to promise you I'm not going to cry on this podcast. I feel like there's a really good chance. Anne Gudger, thank you so much for being here. Your book, The Fifth Chamber, is like my top 5 book of the year. I love it so much.
Oh, Megan, thank you so much for having me. And that just, now I'm all teary. That is just the sweetest, one of the nicest compliments ever. Thank you.
So I use your book in my, actually, I'll send you this text afterwards so you know I'm not lying, but I use your book in my writing class because I like to give people different structure possibilities. I like to give them different ways in which to think about writing. And a lot of what I'm doing in the class is really helping people calm their bodies down to pull away from any of the anxiety that resides inside the system. So it's like this fast moving class where I'm switching things and I'm asking questions and I'm making them read. And I'm sure people are like, what is this lady doing? But it's a little bit the trick of the trade, which is I'm trying to help their curiosity, which can get locked away inside the brain. You and I started to talk before, and I said, hold it. We're going to talk about this in the podcast. Can you start by telling us how you come into the world of grief and loss? And then let's jump in about the embodied writing that you have given us in the fifth chamber.
Absolutely. I come into the world of grief and loss because I was widowed when I was 28 and pregnant with my first child. My husband died in a car accident going night skiing. He was only 36. And as I said, I was only 28. And we were at the start, we'd been married 3.5 years. We were like at the start of things, we just bought a house. I'm pregnant. I had a new teaching job. Like we're at the cusp of everything. And then all that was taken away drastically, quickly. My world just flipped upside down in a heartbeat.
Yeah. I mean, that the fast and furious way that the book starts is, it's really breathtaking. It's really disorienting how the book starts, which is, I was like, as soon as it started, I was like, where are we? What are we doing?
What's happening?
And I was like, oh my God, it's disorienting. She's doing this on purpose. There's just so much about the book that is such gorgeous and beautiful writing. And I think strategic and intelligent and intentional. I compare it a lot to Maggie Smith's You Could Make This Place Beautiful, because I think the structure of the book is critical to helping the reader titrate into the story that they're going to hear. So can you tell readers a little bit about how you wrote the book, what I'm even talking about in terms of the structure? Just dive in and talk a bit about that.
Oh, wow. That's a beautiful tee up. How did I write the book? So first off, it took me years to write this book. My jam is normally essays. I have lots of essays in the world. And one of my first essays, actually the first thing I ever had published, was a mini version of this book. And I was like, I have to write the whole book. And even as a much younger person, when all this was happening, I always knew I would write about it because there wasn't a book like mine in the world. And I wanted it to be in the world. I really lean into language. I really lean into image. And that is all in there. And it also needed a structure. It covers a vast amount of time. It starts with me being pregnant and widowed, and it finishes with my son getting married, right? So, and it's only 270 pages and the chapters are short, right? So it's this huge amount of time. So I had to figure out like how to use the fragments, but make it in a way that was accessible to readers, because I didn't want you to feel lost. I wanted you to be a little, I love that you said you felt disoriented in the beginning, because as you well know, grief is super disorienting. And so I wanted that experience for the reader. I wanted you to be there with me, but I also didn't want to lose you. And so the whole book, all the chapters are titled Before and After. So, you know, we're in the before time, we're in the after time. And part of where that came from is that I'm a firm believer, and that's what grief is. I don't adhere to the traditional 5 stages of grief. I really do believe in before and after. And one of my lofty missions as a writer and as a speaker is to debunk that idea. I mean, I love that we had that and it gave us language. It gave us a way in to talk about grief, but everyone knows who works in the grief world. It's an illusion that there are these stages that we move through in a linear way, because grief is anything but linear.
One of the things I love in the book, because I think it comes a little bit of as a surprise to me, knowing a little bit about you, but having not read the book yet, is that there is the before and after play to me around the concept of toughness, right? The concept of endurance and what is actually hard, what is actually grueling. Can you talk a little bit about the woman that you were and are at age 27 and before, and maybe how you met your husband and the chapters that are in there? Do you get what I'm asking you about?
Wow. Okay. So where do I start with that?
Yeah. There's an after chapter, a before chapter, where you are using an ice pick and allowing yourself to slide possibly to your death.
Possibly to my death.
Of a mountain, and you're learning. And it was making me think about, you know, how I learned how to kayak, or I learned how to sail. And part of it is you need to learn how to tip over. You need to not die when that happens. And you're doing this with an ice pick. You're tiny in this big world. But I want our listeners to understand a little bit the reader's experience, that you are not simply telling a sad story of something that happened to you. You're also telling us about who you are. Yeah. And who you are is an interesting juxtaposition against what it is that you have to go through.
One of the things I really thought about, so for me, writing is always about what's my big question, right? Like, we have a big question that we don't have an answer to. If I could answer it, it wouldn't be worth investigating and writing about and going to find an answer, or at least find possibilities. So like, my big question for my book was, how do you bear the unbearable? And I have it up on my board of inspiration. And as I was writing my way through, like writing the story of what happened, once Ken died and I was thrown into widowhood and single momhood and all those things, I wrote my way through that. And then my question was like, okay, I know what hurt me. I know what hurt me, but what held me? Mm. How was it that I was able to do this? And so that's where you get the before parts. I laugh with my editor. There should be like before chapters. So there are some chapters from my childhood. I had the experience of partially growing up on a ranch with my family, which was great. That informed so much of who I am and so much of my, just my grit and my, like, literally, like, that's the literal get back on the horse. I have that in me. When I was, how old was I? 22. I think I was 22 when I went to Knowles. So I went on an outdoor, I went on an outdoor backpacking adventure in the wilderness of Wyoming. And it was for 30 days. My pack weighed half my body weight. It was 60 pounds. It was a monster. That's how I describe this beast of a pack. I carried it every day, 10 miles a day for 30 days. And it totally built some of my, just my endurance muscles and my determination and my knowing, like, this is hard. I cried so much I was the biggest crier on that trip. And I would go off and cry by myself because I didn't want everybody else to see me. But it really, I talk about in the book, I thought that it was, I was going to find myself because I'd felt that I'd gotten lost as a young woman. So I went to the woods to find me. And really, when I look back, it prepared me more for what came rather than just help. It also helped to heal a lot of what happened before, but it really was one of the things that held me from the start. Even immediately after Kent died, one of the things I kept saying is, it's like being in the dark woods, but this time I don't have a map or a compass or anything. It really did. That's where I built some of my muscles, was on that glacier with an ice axe, thinking maybe I was going to die at the end, but I did it, right? And when you do this super hard thing, and then it's in our bodies, that's part of why I love backpacking. Then it's really in your body. You can always lean into that. You have that memory. You can always, like, just close your eyes and breathe into that moment for a moment. And it gets us through the next hard thing. And I've been doing that. I've been doing that my whole life, I think, honestly. And it's more than, it's also the joy of it, right? I am such a joyful person. Mm-hmm. And that has everything to do with being honest about what was hard, working my way through it, having a lot of therapy, right? All that stuff. Because I just think we have to, you and I talked about this a little bit before we recorded, like, you have to have those honest conversations. I have to have those honest conversations so that I can move through them, so I can find the joy and the light.
Oh, So I loved reading those chapters. I loved reading the chapter about Knowles, which it's like one of the first or second chapters. And I'm like, oh, this lady and I would not be friends. I only go to the woods if there are electrical sockets in them. I'm not hiking. Why would you carry half your body weight up a hill if someone wasn't making you do this? And like, why? Why would you do it? And you're describing it. It's so painful. And you're choosing it, right? And you are showing us just like how freaking tough you are. And like maybe tough for a purpose that is really just for you, right? Like you're not proving, these are strangers you're with. You're not proving anything to anyone. And part of this is also connected to what you've described, which is like a joy and a passion to be outside. So it's not just like a joy and a passion to be on a swing by a lake outside. It's a joy and a passion to be really wholly connect. And I do have relatives and I have seen the joy, but I have not found that to be my world experience. So I really appreciated reading about it. And because your structure is so intentional and because I'm a writer and I'm a curious reader, I was like, but why is she telling us this? It's not just to tell us that she and Kent have this in common, which you do, which is important in your relationship. And I have some chills while I'm saying this. When I was working with my editors, they were like, you have to ask the why of every chapter. If there's not a good why, if it's just you wrote it because it's true, that's not a good enough reason to put it in the book. And so a bunch of chapters that I love, they're somewhere on a floor somewhere. And the ones that are in there to show you, right, that I have all the degrees, I've done all the studying, I've done it, I've done all the therapy myself. And what we know is going to happen because it's on the back book of the book jacket is I am going to go all the way down. I'm going to go all the way down. So I show you all the, I should be tough enough with all my skills and all my tools to not have this be painful, but actually that's not what the toughness is. And that it like opens like a flower in your book, which is look, this little lady is super tough. She chooses to be tough. And then what we see in the after is just a kind of blinding pain that no one ever would believe that they're tough enough for. And that I think maybe you grow the capacity to be tough enough for, that you like meet it in the middle, maybe.
Wow. Yeah, because, wow, thank you. I'm lying on the floor and sobbing so hard and I'm so snotty and I've got carpet fibers. I remember like, why are there's carpet in my nose? Oh, it's because I'm crying so hard and there's so much snot and I'm breathing this in and yeah. I just don't know. I think it's in there. There were times that I would like literally fall down on the stairs.
Yeah.
And not knowing if I was going up or going down and just sobbing so hard. And those, I didn't feel any toughness in me. There's big stretches of time and like my grief undid me. It yeah. wasn't like, hey, look at me. I can do these things. And I can do grief too. My grief undid me. I was not recognizable to myself at that stage. My world got really small.
The other thing that I think you do, because again, there are all these things that people say, you could just write a book that's like grief is lonely and grief is hard and grief is sad and then gets a little less sad and maybe, but you show us very early on the terrifying kind of loneliness that comes when you are doing something that you're not, when you're trying to survive something that you're not sure you can survive because you've never done anything like it before. And I think one of the ways that you pace us in is like, you tell us like about your relationship with your parents. And then there's this moment where you learn that Ken has died and it's not really clear. It's not that there aren't people that could come and they are going to come. But even in that moment, you're like, I'm not sure that's going to be better for me. And so you're really in this thing that I have heard from thousands of grievers, you describe this scene and I'm like, yep, she's 100% alone. And I don't mean the existential, like, I know we're all connected and all. She lost her husband. Nobody else there, anywhere near her, on the planet, in the world, just lost Kent, except her. And you do such a beautiful job of showing it to us. And then I think you keep showing it to us and how it's evolving and how it shifts and changes over time.
Thank you. It's true. Yeah, I had people, but there's so much in grief where you feel totally alone, even though there are people around you, even though there are people who understand and who love you and who love you like crazy and are going to hold you up. And thank all the stars that there are those people to hold you up while you sob. But so much of it, you really, it's why I started writing, right? Like you just walk through it as a solitary human because it's unfathomable, right? When people say, and it's definitely in my book, people say all the time, like, I can't imagine.
I can't imagine.
And in the beginning, I would just say, in the beginning, I said nothing because I didn't have a response to that. And then I started saying, but you don't want to.
Yeah.
Right? Like your brain, no, you're right. You cannot imagine losing. He was my everything, right? He was my husband. He was my best friend. He was the love of my life. He was my, I am going to have this amazing marriage and this amazing life with this person. And the things I learned about from my family, I get to make different choices and it's all good. And it's just started. And he loved me in ways I'd never been loved before. Right. And it was just all so yummy and good. And then it's gone. And that it's, no one can really walk that with you, and they can walk near you is how I always felt about it, but they couldn't. And that it was all that. I can't imagine. I can't imagine. I can't imagine. And at some point I started saying to people, well, go ahead and imagine.
Yes, you can. Yes, just, you can.
Yeah. Just do it. Because when you telling me you can't imagine, you're asking me to comfort you. And I don't have the capacity. I am doing my best to get out of bed every day. I'm doing my best just to do the very simple things I need to do. And then especially once Jake was born, get out of bed, take care of the baby. Like you got to, I had to do that. There was no other option. So that got old for me that I can't imagine, but I did using it in the book.
Yeah, no, you use it perfectly in the book. It's brilliant. And I do, again, I think there are some things where it's useful to talk about them out loud, because what people say, I've said this before, I think maybe you can't imagine what licorice tastes like if you've never had it before. Or you can't imagine, I talked about on your podcast, what the Badlands look like, because you can't get the depth perception until you go there. So I think there are some things where if I just said, oh, I'm going to the Badlands, be like, I can't even really imagine what that's going to be like. Is it hilly? Like I've seen pictures, but I can't imagine. Or like, how do you even describe to anybody what licorice is if they haven't had it before? But I can't imagine what it would be like to have your most important person die. Yes, you fucking can. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. And so what it does is it immediately almost says, I don't want to listen to you. I don't want to hear your story. I don't want to hear your story. I want to look at your story. And that's not what people mean. What they mean is, how are you surviving?
Right.
How are you surviving? And so in some of my grief education, that's what I say is ask questions. If grievers don't want to answer them, they won't. But really what they need is a way to figure out how to say what's going on for them. And your imagination doesn't really play a part. You don't really need to understand. And I also think we do become something. I think I said this on your podcast also. You were becoming a mom at the same time you were becoming a widow. Those two concepts, we can read about them. A friend can tell you about them, but what they really feel like are totally unique to you. But part of when we're saying, I can't imagine, I think really also is I understand that you're becoming something that you haven't been before. You've been this person before. So I don't know what this is going to be like for you, but God, it's so much better to say, what is this like for you?
Absolutely. And I love what you just said. It's so true. Even when people said ridiculous things to me, because people say ridiculous things to grievers, I also knew that that their intention was good. Like that they loved me, and they just said things that culturally we've been taught to say. Right. So it's part of why I do this. It's part of why you do it. Right. I want to give us other options culturally to say other things, to ask questions, to be good with your own discomforts. Right. And to acknowledge that's what's going on with you, but you can still sit with your person. Thing for me has been like being clean in my own grief. I am clean in my own grief. Mm. So I can sit with you in yours. I don't have to,
even though that's good. Oh, I'm going to steal that phrase, because people talk a lot about you can't say something about your grief to someone else. But what you mean is you can't do it if it's not clean. So if you're showing up and you need them to validate you, shut the hell up.
Yep.
If you are able to sit with your grief and it's been processed and you don't need them to do anything, you just want them to know, I've been in the valley. I get it. Then it really can land. Ooh, cleaning my own grief. You just gave me a phrase. I love it.
You're welcome.
Really good. I teach in the book that I just handed in yesterday morning. It's more like a clinical book.
Yesterday morning. Congratulations. Yeah,
thank you. I was at a book thing all weekend. So it was like, it was staying up all night to finish the edits on this book. Like I was in college. I didn't even do that in college. I was like too organized in college. So I pulled an all nighter for a book, but one of the chapters is called Why Do Smart People Say Such Stupid Shit? And right, like, why do you say such stupid shit? And we're never going to answer that question. It's awkward. They don't know what else to say. So there's like homework for both sides. If you're the griever, it really is your job to keep yourself safe and okay. And so if people are saying stupid shit to you, you have to figure out a way to tell them to stop. And I have these lead sentences where it's, I know you mean that with love. I can tell you intend that gently. But also that sucks. So when my mom died, my mom was very religious, deeply Catholic. All of her friends were part of this like little old lady cabal they worked in like a charity shop. And so it made so much sense in my mother's world for people to come and say, now your mother is with your father in heaven. Now your mother's your guardian angel. Except at that moment, I just was like, now she's dead. And so it really killed me that these little old ladies were coming over and they were like, I feel better because of what I'm saying. And I was like, you're punching me in the face. So even with these little old ladies, I had to be like, oh, I know you mean that with so much love, but that's not helpful to me right now. But I would love to hear a story about my mom that I haven't heard. I know she was so funny. And only one person was like, no, but you must find comfort in Jesus. And I was like, okay, we're done here.
We're done.
And I'm never speaking to you again. I gave her like three tries and then we're done. But I think that's one of the things about grief is like when you're the person and it's really hard and it's almost impossible to do anything, don't ask them to do anything. Don't ask them to do more. Don't ask them to instruct their friends and family about how to speak to them. Except what's the choice? No. The choice is then you're just absorbing slings and arrows and probably you're going to end up not speaking to half those people because they're going to be mad at you. I was very generous. I went over to her house and brought her a babka and she didn't even thank me. And you're like, that guy came over here and said this to my face and I'm never speaking to him again. So it's a tricky thing, but the reality is people do. And I'm one of them. I'm sure I've said insane things to people. Because it's so awkward. Just because I know how to have the conversations doesn't really mean that I'm going to do a better job. I still, Colin Campbell, this gorgeous writer, wrote a book called Finding the Words because he lost his teenage children in a terrible car accident where someone who was drunk driving T-boned them and both his children died instantly. And he said the phrase that everyone said to him was, there are no words. And eventually he was like, well, find some words. Like if there aren't, don't just sit there with that. Find some words. And so his book is really a love letter to people about just, these are the action items. These are the ways that would have worked for me. It's not going to work for everybody, but this is it. Like we would have done this and need this better.
Yeah.
So yeah. I really love that. I really love that.
You just make me think. One of the things that I did in my journal, it is not in my book, but there's massive piles of journals that or there were not in my book, but I did. I kept a list called Dumb Things People Have Said to Me.
Ah, yes.
Because I was just like, I know people meant well, but I just have to tell you, because the worst thing someone said to me, and she is not in my life. She hasn't been in my life for a very long time.
Okay,
literally a person came up to me at my husband's funeral, and said, you need to start dating. Your son needs a father. And you're in shock, right? Like my whole body, I'm in shock and I'm 6 months pregnant. And thank God for my sisters who are close by. And I grabbed my one sister and pulled her close to me. And I just looked at my sister and pointed at the person and said, keep her away from me. Like all my higher self protecting me. Like I wasn't about to say, that's a thought. I was just like, keep her away from me. And I always hope for her that somewhere down the road, she realized what a horrible thing that was to say to me.
Who are you to say anything? What do you even know about anything? I really like to hand people back their garbage. Like, you just handed me your trash. I'm not holding your trash. I will not hold your trash. And so I think that woman did not know that she was handing out trash. She thought she was giving out like candy apples. She was giving you good sage advice. And you were like, she just handed me a sticky popsicle wrapper. And now I'm covered in sticky sugar. It's hard. God, it's hard.
It is. And I'm with you. I'm sure. I know it. I'm guessing it happens with you. It definitely happens with me. People look to me now like I'm supposed to know the thing. Yeah. Right. And so what I always say is, I don't always know what to say. I absolutely know what not to say. And I just know the beauty and the power of just being with somebody without saying something stupid.
Yeah.
And that silence is fine. I also know to ask questions. There are no magic words, even though I've been in this world for quite a while. There still aren't magic words. There are still times horrific things happen. And my first response is like, oh.
Yeah.
I have that, oh my God, it's horrible. And I don't know. And I'm like, no, actually, I do know. But
I think it's tricky too. I write about this in the book that's coming out too, about, are you part of the planetary system for the person? Or are you adjacent? Are you more like a little moon that is, because I have like a totally lovely, well-meaning neighbor after my mom died. I saw her somewhere and she was like, we should go get a drink. And I was like, what? We've never had a drink before. Why? I said this out loud because I was like, my head was not well. But I was like, why would we have a drink now? Because I have a dead mom. Do you have a dead mom? Are we going to talk about dead moms? And she was like, no, I just wanted to offer something. I was like, don't offer that. That's dumb. I think there's also this challenge, because even as someone who would tell you, I know how to hold space, I know how to sit with people, there are some people for whom I'm not great, or they're not great for me. And so it's always going to be a car wreck. It's always some relatives who, like, doesn't matter what I do, they're going to be like, don't be a therapist to me. And I was like, I was trying to be your cousin or whatever. So I think also just understanding that, like, A, we're not trying to fix the grief. And B, everybody has a different role. And certainly someone giving you advice about whether or not you should immediately start dating, there's no room in the house or life for that.
Well, it was somebody, it was Ken's best friend's wife, who I barely knew. They'd been married. I didn't really know her. I'd been at her wedding. I'd seen her one other time.
What's her address? Because we're going to send some hate mail.
I know we're going to. Yeah, believe me. It's so funny. Every once in a while, I'm like, I wonder if my book has landed with him yet. I have no idea if those two are still together. That was
sure.
I was like, nope, you are not my people.
The other thing, and I just want to say this out loud, is I understand that, like, Oprah believes, God, I always malign Oprah on here, and I'm going to get in trouble one day because I'm going to, like, meet her. I say it all the time. Like, I could meet Oprah. Anyone could meet Oprah.
Yep,
and she's going to be like, you're the bitch that keeps saying bad things about me. She talks a lot about gratitude, almost like gratitude is going to inoculate you from having bad things happen. And I get that we're supposed to be generous and we're supposed to be grateful and all of those things. I was none of those things when I was deep in grief, none. I was petty. I was furious. And actually, I a little bit enjoyed it. So it did actually make me feel better when the person from the catering company was being annoying and me being like, my mom's dead. Like, it helped me actually to despise some people, to have a villain in the story occasionally. And I didn't need to, as maybe we do as whole people, be like, maybe they're having a hard day, or maybe this is provoking something from them. I just want to say that I'm fully comfortable deciding that Kent's best friend's wife or ex-wife, however we think about her, was just like a bad person who said bad things. I don't need to be more generous. She can be the villain of this particular story. And I'm happy about that. I'm not even going to say I'm sure she's a nice person. For our purposes, she's not.
I just don't know. I have no idea. That is so funny. Yeah, no,
it's
I am.
It's helpful.
It is. And I think it's that thing of being real. Gratitude is my sidekick, right? Like, I live a very grateful life. That's one of the first things out of my mouth when you ask me how I am, right? Whenever we do the, it's part of, so Maria and I run a writing group twice a year. And we always start it when we come onto the Zoom part. So there are parts of it, part of it is not on Zoom, part of it is. And I always start with your beingness. How's your being today? And every once in a while, somebody says, you always say grateful. I'm like, that's true, because I am. But when I was on the floor breathing in carpet, I was not grateful. Some of it's in the book. Like, I know that I was unkind. I know I said awful things. I know I almost ran over the construction guys waving their stop signs at me, because I was just like, fuck you, I'm not stopping.
I don't have to stop.
Yeah. I don't have to stop. I got a baby in the car and I am full of rage.
Yeah.
So I went to the dump and broke all those dishes. That's all part of it. And if I had glossed it over in the time that I was experiencing all that, I think it would have taken me longer to process my grief.
Yeah, because you got to get it out somehow. And
got to get it out.
I talk about anger a lot as just telling the truth. You know what I mean? Like, anger just tells the truth. Like, it can make you feel out of control and it can be really difficult to be around, but it doesn't lie. It doesn't lie. It's going to say all the hard things. It's going to break plates. It's going to do the things. And then usually anger doesn't come alone. There's sorrow and all that behind it, but he needs to break its plates before anything else. I want to ask you to talk a little bit about, because I think it's a thing, you were really young when you were widowed. And one of the things that I've talked to a bunch of authors on this podcast who were widowed, and one of the things is the, like, happily ever after, you find another partner and now everything is okay. And first of all, none of that is in your book. But I'm curious about, can you just maybe give a sentence or two to anyone who's listening about how you talk about the idea that life goes on and that you can have more love in your life and that you can have more life in your life and also continue to mourn and be in pain?
It's tricky, boy, it's tricky. I have written it and said it so many times, and it's so true for me, that grief is sorrow and joy holding hands, right? That one, it does not eclipse the other. For me, it was about a choice, right? Like, I always think life is a choice. And as I moved through my grief, I was so young and Jake was so tiny. And one of the things we laughed about within my family, when I first started going to therapy, I told my therapist, I didn't care about me, but I had to get better for Jake, because I had this vision of him as an adult. I had this vision of him as an adult at his therapist going, my dad died before my mom was, well, before I was born. Sorry. My dad died before I was born. And then my mom went crazy, right? This is not a way to start life. Right. So even though I felt like a shell of a human, then I knew I had to work through it and start healing my heart so I could be a good mom. That was my motivation. And my therapist, who was brilliant and lovely, and you would love her, said, I don't care why you're here. I'm just glad you're here. And so that was like the beginning. And of course, as I worked on, like, how could I show up for Jake? I started seeing, like, how can I show up for me? How can I show up for me? And there's more. I didn't want to be that person who gets to the end of her life and be like, yeah, I had a great life till I was 28. And then I just drew breath for however many years I was going to get. I'd never been that way. I didn't want to be that way. And so I really did just start working on myself and seeing that there was more and that there was the possibility. And I say all the time, like, I'm a beauty hunter, right? And so even in the midst of the worst things, I can find something beautiful. I can always see, it sounds so cheesy, but I feel it so strongly. I can always see that spark of light in the dark. And that's what drew me. That's what drew me. And then when I met Scott, I was like, we're probably just going to be friends, right? Like, I didn't go dating. We were introduced by friends.
Yeah.
I didn't really think I was ready to be in a relationship, but friends introduced us. He was so nice and so kind and so never trying to impress me. He never tried to show me how great he was with Jake or anything. He was just his very gentle, loving, kind self. And I fell in love with him. And part of that falling in love with him also,
I'm just saying, as anyone would.
So one of the things I teased him about, I don't know, a while ago after the book came out, I had said, I don't want to be widowed twice. So I'm going first. And I said, after I go, you should get a puppy. because everybody loves a puppy. Take the puppy to the park. That is how you're going to meet someone. And he looked at me and he goes, honey, I'm just going to give them your book. Because who wouldn't love me? I know. Isn't that?
It's like a commercial for him. It really is. The last chapter, you like, oh, God, it's enough to kill a person.
You got to love this guy. But that just cracked me up when he said that, because he doesn't say things like that very often. But I was just like, oh, that's funny and true. So really, my part of why I hold this capacity, like my heart is huge. I am capable of holding it all. And Scott has never been afraid of my grief, right? So it's like, I didn't have to put it away. I didn't have to be like, okay, because I think that's what people, that's the illusion. Okay, everything's good now. Everything's good. I'm back. I'm happy. I have this beautiful life. I have all this joy. I have this amazing partner. I have this beautiful son. And now we had a beautiful daughter. Life is so good. And believe me, people wanted to just hear that now. Man, what you went through was so hard, but it's all perfect now. And I'm like, it's not all perfect now, because I'm a human. And I still, and this is still part of my life. And because I choose to keep Kent in our lives, and I choose to be like actively processing for myself and my family. When Maria, our daughter, says that she grew up in this comfort with grief because we always talked about it, it always makes me, in some ways, it makes me a little bit sad, because that's not true for everybody. But it also makes me just so like happy and proud, because our kids always had this authentic experience. Everybody's going to grieve. Everybody's going to have loss. And so we might as well talk about it, explore it. So it doesn't have to blindside you like it did me.
One of the things I love about your book, I love everything about your book, but one of the things that I hear about a lot from grievers, and I have this experience myself, is that identity crisis, right? Of who are you? And when I say identity crisis, people are really focused on what they have lost. And there's all this neuroscience about it. Mary Frances O'Connor writes about it, where it's like this disorientation, right? Like all your compass points and the stars in the sky and all of it are gone. And then you're like, I don't know where I am, but I also don't know who I am. Like, am I a person that can figure out how to navigate in the dark? I don't know. And there's so much focus on what I've lost. And I really like to frame it as, and then you have to become something else. You're not who you were before. But I think there's a big fear in that arc across of, what if I become something that is not as good as what I was before? Or what if I become something that I don't recognize? Or what if I become, and I think when we're worried about those things, what we're worried about is, what if I'm traumatized? What if there's no good? What if it's only? But I was a person who was like, the way I would describe myself is, I was happy all the time, just happy all the time. Like, gratitude is not a problem, because I'm looking at the bright side all the time. That does not mean that I didn't have anxiety and depression that came in and out of my life, but mostly my adult life is 10 times better than I ever imagined as a child. Other kids are like, I'm going to grow up and have a mansion. And I'm like, I just hope I can pay my bills. And then I have a couple of friends. That's who I was at 10. And I think one of the things that you show us, because you show us the whole thing, is what it's like to become. But you're becoming not in spite of, you're becoming like in a braid, like you're integrating this. And that really is something that you show us that is of no threat to Scott whatsoever. And I think that's also useful for people to hear, because grieving people can be scary when you hear that someone lost a partner. That is, are they going to be in love with their partner for the rest of their life? Yeah, probably. But that doesn't mean they can't also have love for you if you're not jealous and defensive about it. So there's so many pieces that, like, it's not you're not modeling for us, but you are really showing us. It's, come inside. Let me show you how the wallpaper went up on the wall. It's so beautiful. I'm hoping you will be willing to read page 83 through 85. It's the short after.
It's right before I go sleighing down the mountain.
Right? I know. But I just love this. I feel like people ask me that question, right? And I feel like you answer it and you don't answer it perfectly. It's going to make me cry, just so we know. Just everyone be prepared. I already told you ahead of time. If you couldn't handle that, you needed to leave beforehand, because this chapter just kills me.
This was a pivotal moment. So this is me with my therapist. I was in a support group. We were all young widows. We were all under 40 with children. So I was the youngest member and Jake was the youngest child in the group. And those ladies, oh my God, they're my lifelines. I love them so much. I'm still really good friends with one of them. Liz, who's in the book, that's her actual name.
Oh, wow.
And the rest of them, I changed their names, but Liz is one of my people. Okay. After, will I ever feel okay again? I asked on a Tuesday at group time. Just okay. Not joy, not bliss, not happy. Okay felt hard enough to voice. Because I feel like I'm losing my mind some days, I said, rubbing my empty ring finger with its missing ring groove. I'd love some okayness. Maddie massaged her crooked pointer finger that arthritis continued to warp. Liz sighed, big, a stuck air valve unsticking. Then, probably, Liz said, and smiled a fraction of a smile, almost a lip curl. She fingered her hoop earring. She'd eyed Emily with, remember when I'd ask you to tell me the day that I'd feel better? Tell me the day, even if it's far from now, I'd say. I knew I could get through anything if I had a date. Remember? Emily smiled, her mouth wide as the sky. She cleared her throat, her satiny, salty voice. Of course I remember. You told me you couldn't give me a date or a time, that it happens in its own time. I asked her too, more voices said, this chorus of little animal noises, huhs, from us all. Emily smiled her tender smile at each of us, this circle of love she wrapped us in every time. How'd you get to feeling okay, I asked. Maybe that's a better question. I felt galaxies from glimpsing okayness, and beauty on the other side, nah, that felt impossible. I don't think I'll ever be anything but hurt and scared, I said, and my voice warbled. This wave of shame sloshed in my gut because in my girl training, as the middle daughter of a fucked up family, I'd been taught everything was shinier on a silver platter. I'd been taught to say, I'm fine, over I'm hurting. And here I was, hurt and scared, and saying it out loud. Here's something I don't want to tell you, and it makes me itch in the crooks of my elbows to write it. Hard feelings undid me. Sure, I could name what happened in girlhood, raised up, plopped down by a dad whose morning coffee, half vodka, and a mom who built forts out of self-help books that didn't help, who denied her depression, even though it coiled her and oiled my sisters and me. Me, rooted at odd angles, layered with their poison-spewing divorce in the mid-60s. Sisters and I didn't get the, we're getting divorced and we still love you, girls talk. Parents didn't know how. Dad left and drank. Mom cried lakes of tears. Sisters and I were left wondering if we were the cake or the rain in Richard Harrison's MacArthur Park that mom played on repeat, wearing a cavern in the vinyl. 7-year-old me knew all the words. I still do. How? I asked again to these women who I'd switched from sitting back and judging to trusting to hoping there was hope. I listened like my whole body was an ear. You got to go through it, Liz said. There's no going around, Sarah said, her mouth in a straight line. Keep moving through it, Maddie added. Beth nodded along with all their words, her blondness bobbing like the bouncing ball on sing-along lyrics. Always remember, you've got us and we've got you, they said too. I've got no tools, I said. My stomach shriveled. I didn't know how to say it other than to say it. No map, no compass, no guide. Just me holding my charred heart in an offering. Here's my beaten, beating heart. Me in slump, grief, a concrete coat. And while I said the tools thing, a quiet thrumming in my heart peaked up its beating. Like no tools was true and not true.
It's just so ridiculously beautiful. And because we are coming to the end of our hour together, I'm going to say this out loud because I think it all the time. When I read that section, it's folded over multiple times. You are telling us what it is like to need hope. And when people say, I can't imagine, this is the other side of that, right? This is, I need to be able to imagine. So just give me anything. Give me a random date in February. Tell me that my hair will be longer. Say that I'll know it from the smell of something, but just give me a handrail. And the beauty in that to me is when all the voices say, oh, I asked to. because not everybody is on the same lap of their grief that you are. And just hearing, oh, that's part of it. Part of it is, how will I ever imagine something that can't, my mind can't possibly conceive of? And yet people seem to survive these terrible things. So there must be a way. How will I know when I'm there or doing it right or on the pathway? I would implore everyone listening to go grab this book. It actually is a super quick read. I made myself read it slow. I was like, you get one before and one after, and then you put it down, because I knew it was going to end and I didn't want it to end. And I just, the last chapter, your son's wedding, is just too beautiful for words. It is the thing that I think people want to read and hear and know is possible. And I think it's so important to remember that you're 27 at the beginning of the book. And then your son is, and he's a tiny baby and he's a grown man at the end. I just think there's so much wisdom in every choice that you made, both as a writer and as a griever. And I just feel wildly grateful that it exists, that I got to talk to you about it, that you and I are going to keep crisscrossing our paths. It's just gorgeous. It's just gorgeous. And people should go get it. And remember that I always have copies of the book. So if you can't afford it or you can't find it for some reason, ask your local bookstore to get it in, but also I'll send you a copy. So just get in touch with my team and we'll make sure you have a copy. And I only want to talk to you forever. I never want to get off, but I have to.
I know.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for this beautiful book.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much, Megan. You're just so kind and generous. And I've said about you, you're just such a light and so much love in the world. And I'm so grateful that you're here and that you continue to give grief a microphone. It's so important. And I'm just so deeply touched and honored that you love my book the way you did. And that we had the time to talk about it and just to be together.
Now we've had two dates. So now our third date should be live. I think that's how the kids do it these days. So I'll have to figure out a way to get myself to a coast where I can come and see you. Thank you so much for doing this. And we will just figure out how to talk soon. We'll put all the stuff in the show notes about where to find Anne, where to find her podcast, where to find her writing workshop, where to get the book, a description of the book, all that. So if you need any of those details, look in the show notes. That's where they'll be. And I hope we find a way to see each other really soon.
I hope so too.